very simple considerations, you can already see some interesting things. So really, I'm talking about the shape of this convex shape that represents the space of states. So we know that this has k equal to n squared dimensions. It's a thing that lives in n squared dimensions. We know that the normalized states are in k minus 1, which is n squared minus 1. So that's the dimension of the normalized states. And the object is incidentally, it's got to be a cone, because so the normalized states sort of live up here on this cone. Of course, this is n squared minus one dimensions, this object at the top of the cone. And then you go down to the sort of zero state where all the probabilities are zero at the vertex, at the apex here. The boundary of the set of normalized states is k minus 2. N squared minus 2. But this is a convex set, so it has an extremal set of there's an extremal set of states. So extremal in convex sets, I'm not sure if I ever properly said this, but in convex sets, if I have states P A or vectors P A and P B, then I also have every convex combination in the set. And the extremal elements of the set are the ones that cannot be written as a non-trivial mixture, as a non-trivial combination like this. So in context of quantum theory, you call this pure. Any PA and PV distinct. And for lambda, strictly between 0 and 1. And so geometrically, of course, these extremal these extremal states, well, they have to lie on the boundary, but even more than that, they lie on at the sort of extremal points. So, in the case of a sphere, for example, every point on the surface is extremal because there's no way you can get to this. You can't draw a line through here in such a way that that any part of the line on one side of the state is. So that this line is in the set on both sides. You can only draw tangents, but those, so you can't find these points on this surface of the sphere are extremal. Now, in quantum theory, we know that the pure states or extremal states have dimension well, it's 2n-2 because that's the number of real parameters you need to specify a quantum state. So we have 2n real numbers here because these are complex. But then we lose one real number because of normalization and one more number because the overall phase is arbitrary. So the first case to consider is where n is equal to 2. And then we just have the block sphere. You can check whether I guess everyone noticed that mistake. That should be a 2, of course, there. So then the dimension of the boundary is 2, and that's equal to the dimension of the set of extremal states. And you can see that because you have the block ball, and the pure states are the ones on the surface. Let's try and make this into a ball. And all states on the boundary are pure. But the moment you go above n equals to 2, then the boundary dimension is greater than the pure state dimension. So most states on the boundary are mixed, not pure. We also know that the pure state space is closed because you can always evolve unitarily through a pure state. So you can't come to the sort of edge of the set of pure states. So since the smallest example where this happens is when is n is equal to 3, and if n is equal to 3, then k is equal to 9. So k minus 2 is equal to 7, and I can't picture 7 dimensions. So it's difficult to picture exactly what this space looks like. But I have a kind of example just in 3 dimensions, which illustrates, which has some of these, well, has these kinds of properties just to get a rough feeling. And I was describing this to Ben, and he called it the Pringle. So this is the Pringle space. So imagine you take a ring like this. So a piece of wire in the shape of a ring, and then you gently bend it. So it becomes the same shape as the perimeter of a Pringle. Okay, so let's try and draw this. Okay, so I've taken the ring and I've gently bent it. And so now this is the shape of the outside of a Pringle. And now I'm going to, sorry, this keeps flipping in my mind, which is the front. I'm gonna make this the front, okay. And then that's the back. So now we just, what we do is to take this and complete it into a convex set. So we take this as our set of extremal states on the rim of the Pringle, and then we just complete it into a convex set by joining every extremal state to every other extremal state, and so we get this convex set. And so if you look at this shape, it's got these kinds of features. It's got a continuous set of extremal states. There's no edge. But the surface is of higher dimension. The surface of the boundary is of higher dimension. Or the boundary, rather, is of higher dimension than this set of extremal states. The boundary is two-dimensional. The set of extremal states is only one-dimensional. We have a lot of states that are on these kind of flat parts of the boundary. Any questions at this stage? No? Yep.
I have a question about something you said a while back, actually. Uh-huh. You drew this cone, but I'm not. What is the cone?
So a state typically has a kind of total probability associated with it. Imagine a density matrix. So normally, if we have normalized states, we say that the sum of these two entries is equal to 1, or the trace of rho equals 1. But we can also consider subnormalized states. And then the trace, which is the total probability in some sense associated with this state, is some smaller number. And you can think of that if you have a preparation box that prepares the state. Maybe it has a light on it that flashes when the preparation is successful, when you've prepared the state that we're talking about. But this light will only flash with a certain probability. So the total probability, the sum of these two things, is equal to the probability of this light flashing. So you can see now that because you have some total probability, you kind of have a cone that the sum, that some linear function on this set of states has to add up to a certain number, and that divide that gives you a sort of it gives you a bunch of cross sections of the cone, and this number gets smaller down goes down to zero when the state has zero probability.
And so every horizontal slice of that cone is kind of like a shrunken image of the surface.
That's right. Yeah.
And the normalized states are just like
at the top. Yeah, and it's. And we're kind of focusing on the shape of this set of normalized states at the top, but really the whole cone is interesting. And actually, there's something kind of quite non-trivial in what I'm saying here. There's an assumption. So we're assuming that this total probability with this light flashing doesn't depend on what measurements you do in the future. It's a kind of causality constraint that you know, any choice up here doesn't affect the total probability of this light flashing. Turns out that's a highly important constraint. It's it gives rise to a lot of the structure of state space in quantum theory. I'm not sure I'll get time to discuss it, but there's a thing called the Pavia causality constraint, Pavia causality condition. So that's the cone. And you can also, in quantum theory, you imagine it has this kind of cone shape. You could also imagine that the shape isn't quite a cone and it starts to come to a point like this. You know, that you can certainly consider convex sets where, you know, as the probability of success of preparation increases, you actually get a restricted set of states that you prepare. Okay. And it's interesting just to ask what the states on the boundary look like in the case of quantum theory. Let's just go over here. Well, they correspond to states that have support in a smaller number of dimensions on the Hilbert space. So consider a state like this. So here's a state which is a convex mixture of this object here, which has support in some orthonormal basis. It has support in the states from 2 up to n, and this thing here. And you can see that you can't continue this, that you can prepare convex combinations for lambda between between 0 and 1, but you can't make lambda greater than 1 or less than 0, what am I trying to say? You can't make lambda less than 0 because this thing stops being positive. Quantum states have to be positive. And so you're hitting the boundary. So states in the boundary correspond to things, some of the states in the boundary correspond to things that live in a low dimensional Hilbert space. So another thing we can try to do to get a handle on this is to try to characterize the set of pure states, the set of extremal states in some algebraic fashion. Because if we know the pure states, then you can just take convex combinations and get all the states. So one person who has thought about this is Chris Fuchs. And he has papers with various collaborators. So all of this is motivated within the context of the cubism program. But one of the things he's hoping to do within that framework is to derive the shape of Hilbert space. Well, first of all, we know that a state is pure. State rho is pure if and only if. So basically, projectors are of rank 1 if they're equal to their square. And we know that P, the same information that's in P, can be written as a list of probabilities. As a list of n squared probabilities. So P equals, sorry, rho equals rho squared tells us that pk, so we know that there's a linear relationship here. So if we substitute this linear relationship in here, then what we're going to get is a whole bunch of equations for the pk's. Pk in terms of the other ones, pk primes. So substituting this linear expression, whatever it is, and you can write it down explicitly, you know, very simply. And if you look in these papers, you'll see examples. Then for each of those, we're going to get here some quadratic expressions, some quadratic function of the pk's. So write it like that. We have n squared equations, which is a lot of equations. It's interesting that it turns out there's a much weaker constraint that gives you the pure states with just two equations rather than n squared equations. if trace of rho squared equals trace of rho cubed. And this is a condition that was discovered by Jones and Linden in 2004. It's kind of remarkable that a condition as simple as that would only have been discovered in 2004. Chris Fuchs, who sort of found this condition in this paper, it was just used as a sort of side theorem, wasn't the main point of this paper, kind of rescued this condition from obscurity. He asked around, he asked lots of people who were experts, and nobody had seen this condition anywhere earlier. So as far as he could determine, this was discovered in 2004. It's a very simple condition. Yep.
This condition seems very simply related to the one above it, rho equals rho squared.
In what sense?
Oh, wait, but this is just a trace, and that one's
actually... Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So here we have only two equations,
right.
Rho squared equals 1. Trace of rho squared equals 1 and trace of rho cubed equals 1, just two equations.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a...
It's like all the elements have to be the same.
That's right, yeah. So there we have n squared, here we have just two. So I'll give you the... The proof in this paper is more complicated, but in the first of the two papers I mentioned by Fuchs, the first one is by Fuchs and Schack, they give a very simple proof. It's given in footnote 16 on page 16. Yeah. If what, sorry?
The purity?
No, it's not. Can I give you an immediate reason why not? Let me show you this proof, and then I'll try and answer your question afterwards. Certainly with this proof, you need the cubed as well. So there's got to be an example of a pure state that has trace of rho squared equals... So if you think what, sorry?
I think he said that it was equivalent, just trace of rho squared equals 1.
Is equivalent?
Purity, but that
no, it's not true. So I should have an immediate counterexample, and I don't. hold on. Even here, we're not assuming, we haven't put down normalization as a condition. So without that, we can immediately see. But then that just raises the question, well, maybe trace of rho squared equals 1 and trace of rho equals 1 is a sufficient set of conditions. So that would be the question you're asking. And this proof I'm going to show you needs the cubed. Let me give you the proof, and then we'll see if we can work out a simple counterexample. Okay. So rho is a quantum state, so it's Hermitian. So it has real eigenvalues. So these two conditions we have here give us that the sum of the squares of the eigenvalues should be 1, and the sum of the cubes of the eigenvalues should be 1. I'm going to do this. So condition one up there tells us that is the modulus of the eigenvalues must be less than or equal to one, all I, because these are real numbers. So the squares are positive numbers. Which implies that 1 minus lambda is positive, or greater than or equal to 0. Now, if you take equation 1 and subtract equation 2, we get this equation. And we know, actually, now I've understood the answer to this question. The two conditions, the sum of lambdas equal to 1 and the sum of lambdas squared equal to 1, doesn't imply that the lambdas are positive necessarily. So you can have negative Hermitian operators, which satisfy these conditions. Now, you could just impose positivity. You could say, well, we're only considering quantum states which are pure. The only trouble with that is that its positivity is a complicated thing to check, and the only real way to check positivity is to look at the eigenvalues.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that's the point. So maybe that's what Emerson was saying, so perhaps there's not a... The nice thing about this is it's all algebraic. You can just sort of write down...
In other words, these conditions impose positivity.
These conditions would impose positivity, yeah. So what we're assuming in this is that we're assuming that the density matrix is Hermitian, but we're not assuming that it's positive. And this is nice because we want to get algebraic conditions on the shape of this set of extremal states. So we subtract these two equations, we get this. But now we can see, well, this factor here in each term in the sum has to be positive, has to be greater than or equal to 0. And likewise, obviously, lambda squared, because the density matrix is Hermitian, has to be greater than or equal to 0. And the only way this can be true, and yet this is a sum of numbers which are all 0 or positive. The only way this can be true is if either one of these two factors is equal to 0. And that implies lambda equals 1 or 0. But we also know from the first condition that only one of the lambdas can be equal to 1. All the others have to be 0. All the others are 0. So that means that rho, when these two conditions are satisfied, rho is just given by the taking the eigenstate associated with the eigenvalue that's equal to 1. Yeah.
When you said you were looking for algebraic conditions, did you mean conditions of the form like function of rho equals number as opposed to inequalities? Is that what you meant? What were the non-algebraic conditions?
Yeah. So the thing is, to say that the rho is Hermitian is just a simple thing. You can just check the entries and see that. But to say that rho is positive requires you basically calculating the eigenvalues and checking that they're all positive. So it's still a big algebraic exercise. Yeah, and you, like you say, they would also be inequalities, not equalities. Okay, so that's the proof in footnote 16. One more board here. And yeah, so it's just so now if you take these two conditions, the trace of row squared equals trace of row cubed equals one, then what we have, if we substitute the pk's in, what this gives us that some quadratic function of the pk's is equal to 1, because we know that rho is linearly related to a list of probabilities, and some cubic function . So we have only two equations. One is quadratic, the other one is cubic. It's interesting to compare this with the classical case. So we have a classical probability simplex. So we can write this down as, well, we know that all the probabilities have to be between 0 and 1. And we know that the sum of the PIs is equal to 1 for the normalized states. So what that gives us is the set of normalized states live in this triangle consistent with this equation. And the pure states, the extreme ones, are the ones at these vertexes. We have a finite number of them. Incidentally, you can also here see the cone, because this is the sort of apex of the cone. Then the thing comes out the page until it hits the plane in which the states are normalized. In this case, you can characterize it, interestingly, with two equations as well. We can characterize the pure states. Well, we have that condition just mentioned, and we also have this condition. That the sum of the squares are equal to 1. And that gives us the pure states. So in a sense, in the classical case, the pure states are the intersection of a linear and a quadratic equation. In the quantum case, the pure states are the intersection of a quadratic and a cubic equation. I don't really know what's going on. That's as much as I can say. It's kind of curious. Any questions on this? How much time do I have? That's also true, but you can derive that the trace is that you can drive the trace of, the condition that is true is that the trace of rho is equal to 1. And you can derive that from the two equations you have there. Because you can see we've sort of derived it here. We derived that that all the eigenvalues are equal to 0 or 1. But we know that only 1 can be equal to 1. So that means the sum of the eigenvalues is equal to 1. So we don't need to impose that equation. Although it's not true, incidentally, that the sum of all the probabilities is equal to 1. Depends on how you represent. So in a quantum case, remember, if we had a qubit, for example, we can write so what is true is that there exists a vector, some vector. In this case, the vector would be, and for the normalized states, you can demand so the condition that your state is normalized is really just picking out a plane in the space of in your state space. And if we'd chosen a different set of fiducial measurements, we'd get a different state here. So there are, you can choose sets of fiducial measurement outcomes here corresponding to a single measurement. There are things called informationally complete positive operator valued measures. Have you covered those? No. Oh, okay, right, good. So it's a great subject. Yeah. So that's just a set of positive operators which have the property, well, they correlate. So because it's a POVM, they have to add to 1. But there exist sets of positive operators that add to 1 where k equals 1 to n squared, and they span the space of positive operators, which means that they provide you with a way of finding a fiducial set of measurement outcomes, and then your list of probabilities would add up to 1 for normalized states. Okay. So I don't have anything else to say on this subject. Is there any more questions? No.
I know we've been using them for a couple of days now, but I'm still not super comfortable with the notation here where you write probabilities just as a vector. Because like the state that you just wrote there, I know that's not supposed to be normalized.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what is gamma
representing? Oh, sorry, this is meant to be an R, but
an R.
R, yeah.
Okay, sure.
But what is R representing?
Yeah.
R represents a measurement outcome, measurement, well, a measurement associated with an outcome, and it's really just a measurement where you you do a measurement and then you ignore the outcome. So
why?
In this case, if it's a normalized state, then they have to add it to 1.
So doesn't that remove it? It does remove it.
Yeah, but remember I was talking about somewhere, I think on the obscured board, that you can consider non-normalized states, and that's where you have a light that flashes on your detector.
Right.
Those kind of things are useful if you want to calculate. If you have an experiment like this, here's an experiment that you could do. Here I have a state. I have a device to prepare some state. And I have a measurement over here, and this device has a light that flashes. This is just a brick. I guess B was a good name for it. And so it has no outcomes. It's always successful. This measurement. I always see the outcome, which does nothing. But the thing that's interesting here now to calculate is the probability of this light flashing and well, this outcome always happens. So the joint probability of this light flashing and this brick still being, yeah, just being a brick, is equal to the trace of rho. So if you normalize rho in this situation, you kind of lost some vital information. You can't calculate this probability. And for some reason, the general practice is to normalize rho. Sometimes I like to give lists of things I'm against, just well, in life generally, but in quantum physics in particular. It's nice to know where you stand. And one of the things I'm opposed to is normalizing rho. Maybe I should get a petition going on change.org. Because you're throwing away information, and that information is useful to teach. It tells you the joint probability. The essential thing is if you're calculating joint probabilities for all the boxes in your circuit, including the preparation, then you don't want to be normalizing anything. Okay. So I don't have time to really get into the next subject. Wondering whether I should. Let me just make a few remarks about the next subject, and then I'll leave it at that. It also depends what the next subject is. Okay, I'll just. So we talked about probability theory and this sort of generalized probability theories, but something else is going on here, and it's interesting to think about this a bit more. Kind of what we have is we're putting probability theory on top of some operational structure. So here's if we change the operational structure, then the details of how this probability theory look are going to change. And we want to find a way of putting probability theory on top of, you know, the operational structure we're interested in. So the kind of operational structure that that we've been thinking of, if we spell it out a bit more, it's really circuits. So here's a circuit. Okay, so we have a circuit. This is a preparation. It prepares system AB. We have another box, C. System B comes in, systems A and D come out, and so on. Okay, it's a circuit. And we can ask, how does one go about putting probability on top of an object like this? In this case, it's interesting. Well, first of all, we can try and set up a language to describe these circuits. And here's a way to do it. Well, one language of describing these circuits is just the picture that I've given you. Or we can use some notation. So I'm using red chalk for obscure reasons. So we have box A, operation A, systems A and B come out. A and A go in here. C comes out. This one has B, A, D. This one has C, D. And this is sort of symbolic representation of this picture. Something is missing. We need to explain where the wires go. So let's put some integers in here. So the wire, this wire goes from here to B. It's wire one. Wire two goes from A to C, and I'll just fill the rest of them in. Well, I'm just, so the notation here is that the same, this and this are both systems of type A, but you could have two instances of the same system type. Yeah. Okay, so this comes in from here, three, four. So this is a way of describing this. So what we have here is just a description, a schematic description of the experiment, of the operational structure of something happening in the laboratory. What's interesting is that, although it looks like I've written it in terms of tenses, but this is just a convenient symbolic way of representing this. What's interesting is that if you have tomographic locality, then the probability of this circuit happening, and what I mean here is each of these boxes may have a light that can flash. So there's a probability for all those lights flashing, a joint probability. Probability for this is equal to, where these are now mathematical objects, they're tensors. These are so you can see, and maybe this doesn't make any sense. I can give you a simple example. So the probability of this would then be equal to, this is, equal to that, which is essentially the same kind of thing as saying that the probability is equal to R dot, so P dot R, because this is just a list of, now this is just a list of probabilities, and this is another list of probabilities. So what we see is that this operational structure really is represented in the way you go about calculating probabilities. So if you want to put probability theory on top of some operational structure, it really pays off if you look at the nature of the structure, and then you can see how to put it on top. Yep.
So how do you choose whether an index should be upper or
lower? These upper indices correspond to outputs. So in a sense, time is going up here. So the outputs always, the top of the boxes always correspond to outputs, and so the bottom of the boxes always correspond to inputs. Yeah. And these two things really are equivalent, because all the physical information in this is contained in the graph. You can distort this graph in any way, you still have the same physical situation. And likewise, you can, it doesn't really matter what order these big letters are in, all that's important is where the wires go. Anyway, that's a topic that I may talk about more tomorrow. I'll stop there.